listening to AJ Radio. Good evening, America. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Lisa Stewart, Cliff Stewart, and our special contributing analyst, Lamont Banks. How's everyone doing tonight?
Doing great.
Doing great.
Pretty good.
Doing great.
Our phone number is 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. We want to invite our listeners to call in and join in on the conversation. If you have a question or a comment about anything, we would appreciate that. So, Lisa, let's get started with our disclaimer.
Okay. We want to remind everyone that we are not attorneys, and a Just Cause Coast to Coast does not provide legal advice. You want to contact your personal legal advisor for your legal needs. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests do not necessarily reflect that of a Just Cause or a Just Cause Coast to Coast. And as always, thank you for tuning in this evening and choosing to spend time with us.
All right. Thank you, Lisa. This evening, we're going to talk about pro se litigation, and, you know, that's one of the questions that always comes up with the IRP 6 case, and so, you know, we want to remind our listeners that the IRP 6 are David Banks, Dave Zappolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Gary Walker. We're going to ask to always keep them in prayer, and also, if you'd like to follow along with us as we talk about them, you can always go to freetheirp6.org. Again, freetheirp6.org. And just to give you our listeners a reminder what the IRP6 case is about, IRP Solutions was a software development company that developed law enforcement software for local, state, and federal law enforcement. And in 2005, the business was raided for debt. And so, you know, Cliff, as you know, and as those who have followed the case loyally, you'll know that this case, the wheels fell off of it from the standpoint of from the raid that occurred in 2005, things were just not right. It just did not add up. So you have a raid that occurred. You had two grand juries that were impaneled to get an indictment. You have a case whereby one of the sisters of David Banks was convicted on perjury charges, all that as part of playing, you know, putting her in a position of being a pawn in this case. You have Judge Christine Arguello, who should have recused herself. You have a former assistant U.S. attorney, Greg Goldberg, who orchestrated a lot of the claims against the IRP 6. And hand-fed that, or spoon-fed that, if you will, to Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch. And so, you know, you got a lot of things that occurred here that just do not add up. And so, you know, Cliff, and then, you know, in the case of the, as the case proceeded, you have court-appointed attorneys who did not support the IRP 6 as far as putting together a strategy, and the IRP 6 ended up firing those attorneys because of the fact that one of the things they did not want to accompany the IRP 6 to visit with U.S. Attorney John Walsh when they put together a proffer that outlined what their case was all about and what IRP Solutions was all about.
Right. And the thing that you got to look at and that we need the audience to understand is if you have an attorney and at every turn you ask your attorney, hey, you know, first off, here's the discovery. Here's what the case is about. They don't go through the discovery. And you say, okay, here's a list of 100 people that know the type of activity we were doing as a business. They don't interview any of those people. And we're talking about in the course of over a year. And then you say, okay, well, here is a proffer of evidence. I need you as my attorney to go into U.S. Attorney Walsh to present this, to let him know that what I have here basically proves my innocence, which in itself is a, you know, the fact that you have to prove your innocence is a total slap in the face of the U.S. Constitution, because everybody is supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. And that's supposed to be on the burden of the prosecutor to prove that you're guilty. Well, when you have proof of your innocence, you lay that down to your attorney and say, this is what I have that shows that I'm innocent. Let's go into the U.S. attorney together. I can present it to him, and you basically are there to say that you have my back. And your attorney says, no, I'm not going. I'm not presenting it for whatever reason. How do you feel like that attorney is on your side? How do you feel like this person is fighting for you? How do you feel like they have your best interest at heart when the only interaction they have in the case is when you hear from them, well, the prosecutor says you would be the best one to, quote unquote, flip, you know, take a deal and flip on the rest of your co-defendants when there's no crime that ever happened. Yes. Everybody who's looked at this, everybody who's ever seen it says, hey, you know, this is debt. Just like the professors that we had on a couple weeks ago said, you know, they're trying to figure out how did this ever make it to federal court? How did this ever get in the courtroom? This is a debt collection case. Contract signed between two companies, payments that weren't paid, a letter from the FBI that says, you know, this is a civil matter. There's nothing the FBI can do for you. And then, like you mentioned, Sam, two grand juries to get an indictment. The second grand jury only had one witness, and that was an FBI agent. So then the story can get, strewn, misconstrued, taken out of context, told any way that the prosecutor wants to ensure that he gets an indictment. And to have your attorneys that say, you know, basically I'm not going to fight for you, anybody in their right mind would say, look, I'm innocent. I haven't done anything wrong. I'm not taking a plea deal. And if you're not going to fight for me, I need somebody who will. And in this case, IRP6 chose to fight for themselves because their court appointed attorneys would not.
And, you know, Cliff, one thought hit me the other evening. I was thinking about some of the things regarding this case and how, you know, spanning several years, IRP Solutions had opportunities to do business with major law enforcement agencies. And, you know, the case investigative lifecycle software solution, which was developed by IRP Solutions, got the attention of the Department of Homeland Security because, you know, the Department of Homeland Security was a new agency that was set up to bring under its umbrella several federal agencies to answer to, you know, some of the problems that had occurred during 9/11. Now, you know, one thing that stood out to me is the federal government was accusing IRP Solutions of running a scam and defrauding staffing companies. So if you're running a scam, that for all practical purposes, you don't have anything to – you don't have a product, right? You have nothing. So you're making people think that you got something, but you really don't. Well, if you don't have anything, why did the federal government have to go to all these other agencies and say, don't do business with IRP Solutions?
Right, and you when you look at the opening statement from Prosecutor Matt Kirsch, his statement is that, you know, nobody got rich during this so-called scheme. The basically defendants basically got free labor from the staffing companies. Now, first off, what do you do with free labor? What type of sense does that make? I got free labor for what? First off, you get free labor if you're going to – you use labor to build something, typically a product, either you're manufacturing. In this case, the IRP6 or IRP Solutions, the company, was developing software for law enforcement. You get labor to do that. Why are you developing the software? To have as your product – to sell to potential customers. So how do you say, this is just a scam company, they aren't doing anything, when you're building, you're marketing, and going about to sell a product? That is what is called business. If that's what you're doing and you go into debt doing that, that happens every day. Every small business most of the time goes in debt before they make a profit. Most large corporations go in debt before they make a profit. You look at somebody like, look at Facebook. Before they made a profit, they were just out there, just some social media company sharing a bunch of information, not making a profit. It's like, okay, we're in debt. We keep going in debt to keep the service up because we see how big it can be in the future. And now everybody sees how big Facebook as a company is. to take and say because you went into debt that you were trying to scam another company, that is totally ludicrous, and that is what the federal government has done in this case. But then to take the defendants and for their attorneys not to represent them and something so cut and dry, open and closed as to we're a company that went into debt, develop on our product. And then if you have an attorney who does not take that stance that, hey, these men were developing a product and I will fight for them because there was no crime committed. Without that fight, I would have gone pro se myself too. Like, well, if you aren't going to fight for me, I know how to fight. So I'll fight for myself.
And again, you know, the question comes up very often, quite often, as to, well, why did they go pro se? And like you said, Cliff, when you have attorneys and it is obvious that they are not on your side, mm-hmm. they are not putting together a strategy to help you tell your story, to help you present a case before a jury to show that you were conducting a legitimate business, you were doing business no different than anyone else, which even when you look at the situation of Andrew Alberelli, mm-hmm. An expert witness who was not allowed to testify, who would have testified to the fact that IRP Solutions was conducting business as normal, and it was consistent with the industry. But the jury never got a chance to hear these kind of things. And as far as the attorneys were concerned, you know, they were out of the picture at this time. But, you know, they never really dived into all the discovery. They never did any of the interviews with potential witnesses. They just, it was like, let me collect my 70 hours or 77 hours worth of pay as a court-appointed attorney, mm-hmm. and let me help you negotiate. And then, you know, I move on to the next case. And you know, that it was just not a situation where, like in the IRP 6, okay, if you're not doing anything wrong, then why are you going to say that I did something wrong? And so, Lamont, I know you've done quite a bit of research on pro se litigation, and we've talked about it a little bit on the program before. And, you know, joining us a little bit later will be a professor from the Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology at Loyola. How do you say that?
Loyola.
How do you say it, Cliff?
Loyola.
Thank you. That's one that I always have trouble with. Why can't it just be some other university? At any rate, associate professor from the Department of Criminology is going to be Dr. Jonah Goldschmidt. He's going to be joining us a little bit later. But before we bring him on, Lamont, let's share some information that you have with regard to pro se litigation.
Well, I had the opportunity over the last few weeks to look into the importance of pro se, the purpose of pro se, of course, being the right to every citizen to zealously defend themselves and to represent themselves. And I believe, based upon the research that I had done, it was something that the forefathers put in place because they felt that a defendant could defend themselves, or the accused could defend themselves, in many cases better than probably representation. As we talked about a few weeks ago, the numbers are pretty staggering, that the majority of citizens that have gone pro se feel that they would do it again. Even those that are financially able to attain attorneys, almost a third said they would rather represent themselves because they felt they could do a better job than an actual attorney could do. And I think that speaks to the lack of confidence in the system as a whole, that we believe that based upon what we have seen, you are better off at times to defend yourself. And it makes perfect sense as you take, if you take a few steps back and really look at it in a clear way, it's very, very clear that if, you know, I'm supposed to have an attorney that is there to represent me. I stated before in my wrongful conviction, my attorneys were there almost every other day. They came even out on a Sunday to talk to me about the trial that was upcoming and the strategy. And so I was pulled constantly to meet with my attorneys at the time that I was even in custody at the county jail fighting this case. And I'll tell you what, they showed that they were zealous about it. And if you don't have that, and somebody, you know, you're sitting in county jail and you're saying, okay, these are our attorneys, or you're sitting at home, you're not even in county jail, and your attorney doesn't pick up the phone, your attorney doesn't come and see you, there is no meetings called to discuss strategy and these. Well, how can you possibly put trust and confidence then in them to defend you in the proper way? It's just, it's ludicrous to believe so. And I quote David Banks. He actually had did a writing, and he had said basically that the trial these days has become nothing more than a courtship by attorneys competing for the affection of the presiding judge. Attorneys seem more engaged in massaging the fragile ego of judges by putting on a song and dance act in hopes of carrying favorable rulings. Well, if you have that type of position, David Banks says it very, very clearly, this is what our system has become. Who can perform better for the judge? Who can give the judge more compliments? Who can stroke the judge's ego more? Well, you have six lives at stake here.
That's right.
So is this a Hollywood production, or are we here to defend lives and to defend the rights of citizens? So I think, and I'm sure as we get further in this program, Sam, well, I'm sure we'll go back further into some of Mr. Banks's writings, and what he says, I think, are very informative to those that are hearing.
Well, and Lamont, looking at what David had written before regarding why go pro se, he also said that one of the reasons he fired his first attorney was because that attorney told him that his responsibility, that David's only responsibility, was to offer a plea and decide whether he wanted trial by jury or judge. I mean, what that makes no sense.
I mean, how does an attorney let that come out of his mouth?
And I think the bottom line here is that you have to, if you don't have an attorney that's got your best interest at heart, then you may as well not have an attorney. If they're not doing their job to ensure that you get represented in the best possible way, then they're a waste of time. If they're court appointed, they're a waste of time. If you've hired them and paid them money, they're a waste of money. You can get a bad attorney whether you pay them or whether they're court appointed. It doesn't matter. That doesn't change the type of attorney that you have. Just like you said, Lamont, that your court-appointed attorneys were there, they were doing their job, they were zealous. That does happen. And then you've got those attorneys that are collecting a check, I mean, from you, that are taking money from their clients and still not doing the job that they've been hired to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Lamont, you said that, you know, pretty much pro se litigants go pro se because they have no confidence in lawyers. And
correct.
That could be, you know, paid, appointed. And the question that we have to ask is, are all of these lawyers, whether they're paid or appointed, are they simply incompetent? Are they afraid of the judges? Or have they been infected with the sickness of greed, which is prevalent in the justice system, as demonstrated by Mark Garagos, who was paid by the IRP6, but did no representation? So is it an infection of greed? Is the lack of confidence because they're just afraid of the judges, or do they really just don't care anymore?
Well, here's one point actually to pay attention to is that I think, Sam, we said before that 90% of all, what would you say, conviction rates in this country are plea deals.
That's
is that
it.
Correct? So you can't have a 90% record or percentile, if you will, of pleas without a cooperation from defense attorneys.
Yes.
It's impossible. So if that is something that is success rate, the prosecutors are not the only one responsible. They have to work with defense attorneys, which tells you what. Their motivation is not about to zealously defend their client. It is about to work with the prosecution and get as many pleas as they can possibly get, and that is tragic.
And it's all a front. I mean, it's like you're presenting the image because the Constitution says that you're going to be given representation in court. So it's all a front. And so, you know, that's one of the things. We're going to talk a little bit more about pro se litigation when we come back. I'm going to take a quick break. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our phone number, 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Sergeant Michelle Garcia served meritoriously in Iraq and has the medals to prove it. Soon after leaving the Navy, Lieutenant Chris Scott found a job, a home, and started a family of his own. Corpsman Richard Stokely took the skills he learned in Vietnam and put them to good use as a paramedic. But soon after leaving the military, each of these veterans fell on hard times and faced homelessness. Even after Michelle lost all her savings, even after Chris wasn't able to pay his mortgage, and even after Richard battled alcoholism for years, they each reached out for help when they needed it most. A simple phone call put them in touch with a trained professional from the Department of Veterans Affairs. That call got Michelle a place to stay until she could afford one of her own, put Chris in touch with employment assistance, and found Richard a substance abuse program. These veterans are success stories not only for how they were able to help others while serving their country, but for how they were able to let others help them. If you know of or are a veteran in need, make the call.
Talk, news, politics, and inspiration.
Good morning, students, and welcome to Career Day. I hope you're excited to hear about all the great things you can do when you grow up.
Hi, everyone. I'm Emily. I'm super excited to introduce my dad, because he's my hero. When I was little, my dad was away a lot. But I was okay with that because he was doing his really important work driving ambulances in Iraq. Now he's at home, which is great for me because I get to see him every day now. And he's still the biggest hero I know because he tells all the ambulances and the fire engines where to go and rescue people when there's an emergency. I'm so proud of him. He's awesome. He's my dad.
If your service-connected disability prevents you from continuing in your civilian career, Voc Rehab offers counseling, training with a living allowance, education, and other services to help prepare you for your next mission.
On November 11th, we pay tribute to all veterans of our nation, past and present. It's a very small token for those who have sacrificed so much for the freedoms we enjoy today. We salute all who have served this glorious nation in uniform, including those who are currently serving in the armed forces. On this Veterans Day, we ask you to honor your co-workers, neighbors, and family members who are veterans, and thank them for their service. This message brought to you by the wartime veterans of the American Legion and this station.
The opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Lisa Stewart, Cliff Stewart, and our special contributing analyst, Lamont Banks. This evening, we're talking about pro se litigation and the IRP 6. So, Cliff, let's talk about Judge Christine Arguello and a judge's responsibilities when it comes to pro se litigation. I know we've had, you know, over the last couple of years, we've conducted several interviews and talked to several professionals as far as attorneys, judges, prosecutors, and just across the board. And, you know, in one conversation we had, one attorney shared with us that he felt that Judge Arguello held the IRP 6 to a higher standard
right.
than those who are trained litigants. And you know, and that her obligation as a federal judge should have been one that should have shown just a little bit more leeway with the IRP 6. But it seems like she more so gave more leeway to the prosecution and as he said, held the IRP 6 to a higher standard.
Well, the thing is, when you look at the position that that Judge Arguello took, you know, in the case, I wouldn't say that, you know, she gave leeway to the prosecution. She helped the prosecutor out. She ensured that everything that he wanted done in the courtroom was done. Every strategy that he used, all of his crooked strategies, every type of way that he went about to ensure that the case went his way. The judge went right along with him from interfering with witnesses, you know, witness tampering, being in touch with the defense witnesses, knowing where they're at when the defendants don't, contact with them, saying in front of the judge, yeah, I talked to this person on the phone, they called my office, you know, I know that he's out in the woods, he's been hunting for this many days, that many days. Some of the other defense witnesses, he's telling the judge, yeah, I've been in touch with them, and, you know, they've told me this, they've told me that. From all these things to even when the judge pulled Andrew Albarelli off the stand, you know, Matthew Kirsch, the prosecutor, he objects to Andrew Albarelli being there, and Judge Arguello just pretty much goes right along with him. Doesn't even give the IRP6 as defendants, doesn't even give them the chance to say, let us validate that this is an expert witness. You can ask him questions. The prosecutor can ask him questions. We want him as an expert witness because he can refute everything that the other staffing companies are saying. Instead of her doing that, she says, no, his testimony is basically going to be redundant. But then you look at it and you say, okay, well, the prosecutor put about 30 people on the stand from these staffing companies, some of them who had no dealings with IRP Solutions. How do you say that their testimony wasn't redundant to what each other had said, but then you say that Andrew Albarelli, as an expert witness, his testimony would have been relevant? These are the type of things that she did to ensure that the prosecutor had exactly what he needed to put the IRP6 in the position that they were put in. Those are the type of things when you say, okay, these are pro se litigants, they should get some leeway. You should give them the benefit of the doubt as a judge, not doing anything special for them, but just ensuring that the play field is fair. I often say that the judge should play referee. And in this situation, she in no way did that. She ensured that at every turn, the ball was passed over to the prosecutor.
And, you know, Cliff, when you look at the Code of Judicial Conduct and the canons that the judges should adhere to, and canon number two basically is about impartiality and fairness. And, you know, there are a lot of folks that write about this, and particularly when it comes to pro se litigation. And one attorney named is Samuel Stratton, and he also has a blog and a website called The Legal Intelligencer. Mm-hmm. And he writes that, you know, under the Code of Judicial Conduct, a judge has to uphold the law and perform all duties of judicial office fairly and impartially. And his duty is found, again, this is in Rule 2.2 of the Judicial Code of Conduct. And it says that, or comment number four in this rule says that he's saying that it is not a violation of this rule for a judge to make reasonable accommodations mm-hmm. to ensure pro se litigants the opportunity to have their matters heard fairly and impartially. And that goes back to your comment about being a referee, so to speak. It's like the judge understands all the rules of engagement. The prosecutor understands all the rules of engagement. A pro se litigant does not necessarily understand all the rules of engagement, but once explained, or if explained, you know, then they can at least conform to that. But if the prosecutor uses it to his advantage, knowing that he's going against pro se litigants, and the judge allows this to occur, then the judge is not ensuring that, you know, a case is moving forward fairly and impartially.
And in the case of Judge Christine Arguello, it was so clear that she wasn't trying to be impartial. She wasn't trying to ensure a fair playing field. She wasn't trying to make sure that the defendants had their case heard properly. Her whole thing, you could see that she was appalled at the fact that the IRP6 had the audacity to represent themselves. She's looking at this like, how dare you come into my courtroom to represent yourself against, you know, basically one of her co-workers, a federal prosecutor, because they all work for the same people. You know, they're all like DOJ employees. And so that is how Judge Christine Arguello basically looked at this, like, hey, you're in here, you're fighting against a professional prosecutor. So there was no help from her, but she ensured, she's like, I'm going to make sure that you know that you don't come in my courtroom as a pro se litigant. And she did everything to ensure that they knew that, including withholding their evidence, keeping their witnesses from testifying, violating their Fifth Amendment right by forcing one of them to take a stand. All these things that she did basically went back to, you're not going to come in my courtroom as a pro se defendant and get away with it. And that is not the way that the system is supposed to work. The system is supposed to be there that every citizen of the U.S. gets a fair and impartial trial. And whether that's in the federal system, whether that's in the civil system, it should all be the same. And I feel, and several others, professionals mostly in the justice system, that we've personally talked to, that says Judge Arguello failed in her job to ensure that these defendants received a fair and impartial trial.
And even under those harsh circumstances, the IRP 6 actually represented them themselves in a stellar fashion.
Exactly, and yeah. I think that was one of the things that really, you know, for lack of a better phrase, boiled her blood. I mean, yeah, she's a witch, so she can still survive with her blood being boiled. But that is one of the things that really made Judge Arguello angry, is because you come in here and you basically, you're holding the prosecutor's feet to the fire. You are basically objecting, catching him in lies,
impeaching
most of his witnesses, and she took great offense to that.
Yep.
So, you know.
Well, let's bring in someone who knows a little bit more about this subject. Let's bring Dr. Jonah Goldschmidt on. He is an associate professor in the Department of Criminal Justice from what university, Cliff?
Loyola, Sam. Say Loyola. Like you're going to say loyal, but Loyola.
Yeah,
like canola, Loyola.
Just what Cliff just said. Hello, Dr. Jonah Goldschmidt. How you doing this evening?
Yes, sir. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So we're talking about pro se litigation this evening, and I know that you have quite a bit of background on it. You have books that you've written regarding pro se litigation. So share with our listeners your background, and then let's get into, you know, some things that we should expect, some things that our listeners should expect when it comes to pro se litigation.
Well, people have always been representing themselves in the courts. In fact, before lawyers were permitted in the courts in the late 1700s, everybody was a pro se litigant in England as well as in the colonies. Then lawyers began to be permitted to assist. In fact, that's why the Sixth Amendment refers to the right of a defendant to have the, quote, assistance of counsel. And that's how it began, and then eventually it took a number of decades. Eventually the lawyers became the sole spokesperson for criminal or civil parties. Anyway, so in the late 90s, my research showed an increase, a dramatic increase in civil pro se litigation. That was a national phenomena. And when I was with the American Judicature Society, which is a court reform organization, we had a grant project which involved a national survey of judges and court managers, and we found that they were all experiencing an uptick in pro se civil litigation. So I've been doing research on that issue for a number of years, and more recently I turned to the criminal side of things, looking at criminal pro se defense. So that's my current interest.
Now, as I look at one of the, I don't know if this is a study or a survey, says, how are courts handling pro se litigants? Results of a survey of judges and court managers. And, you know, that question, how are courts handling pro se litigants, it makes it seem as though that there's this stigma attached to it. And, you know, and so someone walks into your courtroom as a pro se litigant, you know, you can almost read between the lines and say that the attitude is, you know, what is this guy doing or this woman doing walking in here? representing themselves. What am I going to do? How am I going to handle this? So, you know, what is that survey about?
Well, it's the same survey that resulted in a book published by the American Judicature Society in 1998, and that article is just a follow-up, kind of a summary of the results that we obtained in that survey, which were then published initially in the book. But essentially, what the judges and court managers were saying is that this system is created and designed for people that are roughly co-equal in the sense that they are represented by lawyers, presumably competent. And so that creates the equality, so to speak, that the system establishes. And pro ses just don't fit into that system because clearly they lack legal knowledge and skill. Judges are advised by the U.S. Supreme Court in its 1976 decision in Ferretta versus California, and a later decision, McCaskill versus Wiggins, in the 80s. The Supreme Court declared that pro se defendants in a criminal context are not entitled to instruction on the law from the trial judge. And so judges have, you know, they see themselves as being the impartial arbiter between two parties co-equally or equally matched because they're represented. And then when you throw in a pro se litigant, it just muddies the water, so to speak. They're not used to having pro ses. And they try to encourage people not to represent themselves. Their difficulty is that they walk kind of a tightrope. You mentioned fair trial, the right to a fair and impartial trial. Well, that's what they're required to provide on the one hand, but on the other hand, the Supreme Court has instructed them that they're not required to instruct the pro se defendant in a criminal case, or civil for that matter, what to do. And so they are very concerned. This is a major problem for the court, although they call it a problem, but I called it in the book, it was titled Meeting the Challenge of Pro Se Litigation. So it's more of a challenge to me than a problem. But courts generally view it as a problem, and they are looking for guidance on how to balance their duty of impartiality against their duty to provide a fair trial. And this is a very problematic situation because they don't want to be accused of being biased in favor of the pro se party on the one hand, but then they know that they might get appealed if they don't treat the pro se fairly. And they do need guidance. And in some of my writings, I have advocated that American law should change and follow British and Canadian law. In Canada especially, but also in England, judges have a duty to provide reasonable assistance to self-represented parties, civil or criminal, and they do that. So I've written about their methods of providing assistance that is not only required, but permissible and possibly impermissible. But they do a much better job in the British Commonwealth countries than we do in actually having judges provide that assistance. They used to at common law before lawyers entered the courts. Judges were in the role of providing assistance, helping the self-represented litigant to prove his or her claim or defense. But with the rise of lawyers as an actor, as the actor for the parties, judges no longer followed that role. They dispensed with that role of protecting the pro se defendant, and that's in the hands of lawyers. And so you've got this very strange situation of where many judges, they don't necessarily dislike pro se litigants, but they just think that being pro se, having a pro se party, puts them in a position that's an untenable position. In other words, they'd like to help out, they like to provide information and assistance, but yet they're scared that the represented party or their counsel will complain that the judge is lacking impartiality, he or she is biased in favor of the pro se, and so forth. And so this is where we are right now. That's the situation.
Now, Mr. Goldsmith, Lamont Banks here, contributing analyst here, a quick question. Would you agree with the fact, and I understand that position and the point that you're making, I got that loud and clear, but however, my understanding is that with a attorney, a person who is desiring to go pro se, there is, my understanding, a hearing where a judge will determine if a defendant is competent or able or has some type of intellect in order to proceed pro se, because they have the authority to say, I will allow you to do that or I won't. But again, you're talking about a very fine line here, because you're entitled to that under the Constitution or under the what the concept of our forefathers were for self-representation. Would you agree that I understand that you have the danger, as you said, that they may be accused of leaning towards pro se, but at least in the things that we have seen and some of the research that I have done, I have found that they're going too far to the left, where not only are they not even extending a common courtesy to the pro se defendants, I mean, not a favorable or leaning toward, I mean, we're talking about just common courtesy to those pro se defendants. Would you agree that there's an imbalance going on with that right now?
Well, you're right about the hearing. It's called a Feretta hearing, based on the Feretta versus California decision. And the court, the Supreme Court, requires that waiver of counsel, of course, be voluntary, knowing, and intelligent. And then that's one part of the hearing. And then the second aspect is to make sure that the defendant, or, well, we're speaking now in the criminal context. This is only required in the criminal context. But in that context, the court said that the other part of the hearing has to do with informing the defendant of not only the possible penalties that he or she may face, but what they call the dangers and disadvantages of proceeding pro se. And so, yes, they go through that colloquy with the defendant, but the law is very clear that the court really doesn't have much discretion. Lack of legal knowledge and skill is not a grounds on which to deny the constitutional right to proceed pro se under the Sixth Amendment. It's a corollary right to the right to assistance of counsel. Now, as to how they're being treated after this hearing, judges differ. Judges' opinions are not uniform. You've got judges that I guess you could say are more liberal or progressive, and they're going to go to the outer limits of assistance without overreaching or trying not to overreach, while other judges would rather just be the proverbial potted plant. Tell the defendant that, okay, you want to know the law? There's the law library. There's a rule book. And, you know, they're very curt with these defendants because they really don't want to give them a law school in 20-minute lesson. And they're upset about it. They can't do anything about it. These individuals have a right to be there. But they find themselves on the horns of a dilemma. And so you have a range of judicial attitudes. That's another finding that we obtained in our survey. You do have judges that are very willing to help. They will go much farther than other judges to help. And that's really a problem because you've got a lack of uniformity of justice. You can go into one, a very liberal-minded judge, and that is helpful. And you can go in another courtroom where you're dealing with a judge that really doesn't want you there and going to essentially let you, you know, shoot yourself in the foot, so to speak.
Professor Goldschmidt, let us go to a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more, pick your brain a little bit more about pro se litigation. Joining us this evening is Professor Jonah Goldschmidt, professor of criminal justice and criminology. Our subject this evening, we're talking about pro se litigation, and we're going to share a little bit more about the IRP6 situation as well as we talk about this. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our phone number this evening, 347-838-8976. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere.
I wanted to be in the military since I was a kid.
I served in the United States Air Force.
I served a total of 16 years.
I was deployed 13 times.
On my second deployment, 4 bombs hit my vehicle.
And at 19 years old, that's the first time I ever saw somebody die.
Coming back, I was raging.
I started having pretty horrible nightmares.
I would wake up in the middle of the night, sweats.
I started drinking a lot.
I felt worthless.
I guess I never recognized it in myself.
Eventually, one day, I just walked into the VA hospital and said I'd like to see somebody.
Don't suffer alone. You got to find that link with somebody that'll make you let it go.
It all starts with going to the VA. There's a whole community of veterans that just want to help you out.
It's for the guys who couldn't come back, so you owe it to them to live well because they're not here with their families.
Thanks for listening to AJC Radio. Call in at 347-838-8976 and share your stories and comments about judicial injustice. Be a part of the AJC Radio Show every Tuesday and Thursday night, 6 p.m. Mountain, 8 p.m. Eastern. The number again, 347-838-8976 or www.blogtalkradio.com and search for A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Joining us this evening, Professor Jonah Goldschmidt, Professor of Criminal Justice and Criminology. Again, thank you for joining us. Professor, I want to kind of have you elaborate a little bit on one of the points or one of the questions that Lamont was speaking to just a moment ago. And one of the things that we observed in the IRP6 case, and I don't know if you had an opportunity to look at a little bit of that information, a little bit of that case, but
yes,
you
sir.
Made a great. So, but you made a comment that, you know, judges are in a position a lot of times where they don't want to guide a pro se litigant, don't want to hold their hand. One of the things that we observed in the IRP6 case is it seems that Federal Judge Christine Arguello, it seems as though she went so far to the other side as to, and we've made comment from the standpoint, to hold the IRP6 to a higher standard than those who are trained. And like you said, you know, judges don't want to give a 20-minute lesson on courtroom procedure and protocol, but is there that danger of a judge going too far to the other side?
Well, the problem really is the Supreme Court's language to the effect that the trial judge is not obligated to provide the pro se defendant with instruction, legal instruction. So that's kind of the cover for many judges. They could point to that language and say, see, the Supreme Court says I don't have to do what you want me to do. But again, in that survey that we conducted, we saw a lot of judges felt badly about that. I mean, they did want to try to help, but they couldn't figure out how to do it. But there are ways that are used in other countries like Canada. I keep mentioning Canada because it's a very progressive system, whereby they have a number of different options available. They have lawyers that are in a courtroom. Every criminal courtroom has a what they call duty counsel. It's an attorney who's got the duty to be in that courtroom that day, and whenever there's a pro se litigant, defendant, or civil, a criminal or civil party, they can refer that party to the duty counsel, who can then explain to them what's going on and give them some basic instruction. There's also another procedure called the McKenzie Friend, based upon a divorce case in England between the McKenzies, whereby one of the parties, I guess it was the husband, had an accountant there to assist him. And the court said that people who are self-represented are entitled to bring in a friend. It need not be an attorney. It can be some other intelligent person that can help them, maybe emotionally or with the legal procedures. Things like that are useful. We don't have them here because we have a kind of an all-or-nothing system. You're either on your own, floating around trying to figure out what's going on, or you have to pay or have an attorney appointed for you. There's no middle ground, and that's another part of the problem in our system. But yeah, you know, like I say, when a pro se defendant is treated shabbily because they don't know the courtroom decorum or the rules of procedure or evidence, the judge has this covered. The Supreme Court has spoken, and until they change their mindset, which may happen in the future, then judges can rely upon that language, and they know they're not going to be reversed. As long as they've gone through the proper colloquy, they've gotten the knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver of counsel, and they've explained the potential penalty and the dangers and disadvantages of going pro se, well, then they're off the hook. And no matter what happens, it's going to be, you know, the appellate court's going to say, well, you wanted to go pro se. You had a fool for a client, as they say, and it was your fault, and it's too bad. But that's not the way it works in Canada or England, as I say, and that's been one of the themes in my research and writing. I'm trying to get courts to come around and adopt the Canadian approach.
And Professor Goldschmidt, this is Cliff Stewart. One of the things that, you know, that he says, the judges sometimes they say, you know, it's either they have the rule of Supreme Court to fall back on to say, hey, pretty much, you know, I don't want to be bothered with trying to pick apart the rule to see if I'm in the right or not. And then the other judges say, you know, hey, I would like to help more, but I really don't want to get into it with the prosecutor for the prosecutor to be able to say that I basically I helped out too much, that I wasn't fair and impartial. And you know, kind of from my standpoint, especially from a federal judge's standpoint, you know, you look at them, they have this lifetime appointment, and I look at the constitutional creed that says that, you know, all defendants are innocent until they're proven guilty. So my question is, if these judges are in this you know, kind of a rock and a hard place to come to some conclusion on what they're going to do about the pro se defendants. Why are they reluctant to ensure that presumption of innocence for the defendant? I mean, what would actually happen to a judge? I guess I can put the question that way. What would happen to a judge if they ensured that a pro se defendant wasn't getting railroaded by a prosecutor? What actually would happen to them from a legal, judicial, kind of disciplinary standpoint?
It's a good question. Judges fear being accused of lack of impartiality, and if a judge lacks impartiality or is biased, the judge may have to disqualify him or herself, or one of the parties might on their motion move to disqualify a judge for overreaching, as they call it. That would be the result of a judge who might have assisted the pro se defendant too much. But the test for that, whether a judge should disqualify him or herself, is whether a reasonable person would question the impartiality of the court. And in fact, this is an area that I'm working on right now, because I did a survey of family court lawyers in Canada at a conference I attended, and I presented them with a number of vignettes asking them to indicate whether the judge was acting impartially or biased in favor of one of the other parties. It was a fictitious divorce case. And so the bottom line of that study was that we saw that these Canadian lawyers, of course, they're used to judges providing some assistance, but they have the same concerns that the judges would become biased. They actually are much more lenient and will accept a greater extent of assistance than what I think American lawyers would accept. And now I'm doing a study, I'm preparing a survey to our local criminal court judges, a similar survey based upon a hypothetical criminal case. And I'm going to see how those judges respond to the hypothetical judge in the vignettes. And then we're going to compare those results, those views, with the views of lay persons and also lawyers. And then we're going to compare the results of the three groups. And I suspect, I can't predict, but I suspect and anticipate that when lay people read the same vignettes, they're going to say that this judge could have done more and was not biased in favor of the pro se defendant, that he did properly assist, and in some instances could have done more. And what I wanted, what my goal is to present this empirical data to courts to show that judges and lawyers in America are so conservative in this area, in this realm, more conservative than the lay person, the reasonable person. But if the standard of disqualification is whether a reasonable person would question the impartiality of the court, and we've got a survey here with data showing that reasonable persons, lay persons, would expect more, I'm hoping that will persuade courts, and especially appellate courts, to apply that standard. And unfortunately, the procedure now is when a party files a motion for disqualification claiming bias, it's the judge who's accused of being biased that makes the decision as to whether a reasonable person or persons would question his or her impartiality. So it's kind of a strange system that the accused judge makes a decision as to whether a reasonable person would question his or her impartiality. But anyway, so that's the test, and they're just, these judges are, you know, looking over their shoulder. They're worried about appeals, and they are going to be very, very cautious and try to, stick to a non-involvement position, whereby they don't have to provide any assistance other than very, very basic assistance, such as, the prosecution will put on their evidence first. You can cross-examine. Then after their witnesses, you're going to put on your defense and so on. You know, it's very, very basic information that most pro se defendants already know from watching maybe old Perry Mason reruns or Law and Order. You know, they have the basics, but of course they don't understand a lot of the courtroom decorum practices, rules of evidence. In fact, I recently wrote an article suggesting, arguing that judges have an obligation to provide pro se defendants with a list of available defenses. This used to be required by the Supreme Court, and in a number of rulings, they basically did away with that aspect of presiding over criminal cases involving a pro se defendant. Right now, no court, or very few states, there's a handful of states that do require judges to inform defendants who are about to go pro se what available defenses there are, legally recognized defenses. But that's what they used to do, but they don't do that anymore in general. So the pro se defendant is really in a difficult bind. I get calls almost every week from various pro se litigants, civil and criminal, all manner of people in all types of cases, and they're having a hard time.
Professor Goldsmith, I have a question for you. It's sort of a scenario I want to pose to you, and borrowing from the pages of the IRP 6 case, whereby the prosecution, like you said, you know, anyone, and you kind of, going for that group who remember Perry Mason and those court shows back then, but
yeah.
Understanding the, you know, the normal, what you would think as the course of a trial, you know, the prosecution, then the defense, and just questioning and answering and so forth. But again, borrowing pages from the IRP 6 case where the prosecution indicated that they, you know, they were going to take so much time to present their case. They ended their case a week and a half to 2 weeks early, thereby putting the IRP 6 in a situation of their witnesses were not readily available to appear in court, some of which were traveling from out of town, East Coast, and so forth. So the Judge Arguello, put the defendants in a situation whereby, you know, she had them going line item by line item. Who are you anticipating calling on what day? Clearly in the presence of the prosecution, and putting them in a prejudicial situation where basically making them expose what their strategy was for calling certain witnesses. The judge did not. Not being an attorney, but I would just think that the judge has an obligation to ensure that subpoenas are enforced. When the IRP 6 explained, you know, that they had served subpoenas, but people were avoiding them. Certain government witnesses were avoiding them. And instead of the judge, and Cliff likes to use the term being a referee, and instead of the judge putting herself in that situation of ensuring that there is a level playing ground maintained, she basically put the IRP 6 in a position of being prejudiced against and favoring the prosecution. And you know, when you talk about doing a study and presenting to people, you know, from a standpoint of a reasonable person would look at a situation this way or that way, given that scenario, what should a reasonable person expect? I mean, should a judge, I would expect that a judge would not put me in a situation where I'm laying all my cards on the table in front of the prosecution.
Well, I know from reading the information I was given about how this came down, and it really, well, a couple of comments. First, on appeal, and I assume there's an appeal pending in this case, but the issue is a due process issue. It seems to me the judge should have entertained their motion for a continuance. The problem is another kind of a structural problem with our American courts. Again, I allude to the Canadian experience. In America, we have this notion that once a trial starts, it has to continue until it's over. And this is in contrast to Canadian practice and that of other countries, in which if there's a sound reason to postpone the continuation of a trial, it's postponed, and parties come back on another day, and it's not a big deal. But in America, there's this notion that once a trial begins, it's got to end, and we don't want everybody coming back again, one time, two times, or whatever. Everything has to be done. It's a cardinal axiomatic rule, which should not be the case. Again, there are judges who are more lenient, especially, I think, and mostly in civil cases. If a witness is unavailable, they will reluctantly continue the case, you know, to a new date. But in criminal cases, they just are loath to do that, and they want to push it to the end. And so these defendants in this IRP 6 case, it sounds like, were the victims of that kind of philosophy, that cases, trials, cannot be postponed for any reason whatsoever, unless maybe, you know, death of legal counsel or something like that, which wouldn't be relevant here. So I think that's the problem, but I think it is. It was probably prejudicial. I don't know enough about all the different witnesses and what their reasons were for not attending and so on, but if a case can be made that witnesses could not attend because they were unable to come to this new earlier date, they had established, you know, they had carved out their schedule for a later time and just couldn't possibly come any earlier. Why, that seems to me would be a denial of due process on the part of the judge.
And to that point, I think you articulated it quite well from the standpoint of the judge not granting a continuance and actually, you know, even going so far as to coerce, compel, force the IRP 6 to take the witness stand, thereby violating their Fifth Amendment Fifth Amendment right. And it wasn't a matter of witnesses not being able to get there within, you know, that day. It was a matter of that it just was not reasonable. I mean, from the early, you know, the pretrial conferences, and with the defense having the understanding that the defense or that the prosecution trial was going to take X number of weeks, you know, they planned accordingly. And so when you go to the extent that the judge actually is making comments to you as a defendant and saying that if you don't have your witnesses here, I'm going to consider the defendants to have rested their case. And then, and also to say that I'm telling you right now, if you don't have witnesses to go forward, I will consider you to have rested your case. I mean, that's several instances where that was said. Professor Goldschmidt, we have a caller. Cliff, let's go to the phone.
Yeah, and I mean, to Sam's point, this is a 45-minute window that the judge didn't want to continue on. And we have caller Rose. You're on the air. Go ahead with your comment or your question.
Yes. I was listening to the professor, and he was saying more or less that the criminal case here in America, when you go to criminal, when you try a criminal case, that they're in a hurry to get it over with. I was reminded when the IRP 6 had gone to trial that she prison right away, more or less saying to them that they had to get them back in prison as quick as possible. That's what the prosecutor said. And then they got out on probation for a period of time, and but they were in a hurry to get it finished. And I think this sense of urgency to get it done right away, we want to be sure we get you in prison, because once you get in prison, it's very hard for you to get out. It's almost like it's almost impossible. And I was saying to my son on today, I think that we as the American people need not be so naive as to believe that we have an alternative. I think we're told about all these different alternatives, but when you actually try to exercise something within the realm of the alternatives, you find out that there's not an alternative. Things are done very wrong and underhanded and what have you. And so so I think that's the thing that probably troubles me, is that we don't have an alternative. We're told that we have one. Even when they filed a thing with the bar on Mark Garagos, it says, okay, if your attorney didn't do right and he was unethical or whatever, okay, just file a complaint. Those complaints absolutely mean nothing. It's a facade that's set up there, okay? This is what you got. Look at all these privileges. Look at all these alternatives that you have. And in actuality, you don't have those alternatives. They're just a front. And I think the sad part about it is that when you really begin to dig into it, you find out there's no substance to it. And so if a lawyer is wrong and mistreats you and you file something with the bar takes the lawyer's side. If you file with the appellate court usually rules for the lower court. And so it's like, where are the alternatives? Where does the real truth lie in our judicial system or our due process? It's so greatly missing. And so, I mean, it sounded different, for those people that say in Canada, it'd be nice if we adopt some of the things they do and bring them over here to America. But it's just so sad to see people believing in a system that looks so good. But when you really get down to it and you get involved in it, you find out it's just a front, but it has no substance to it. So all the things about a fair trial and all these things, bring your proper evidence, it's all just a front, because if the judge don't want you to bring in your evidence, she doesn't let you bring it in. If you've got all these things that would vindicate you in front of the jury, she sees to it that it doesn't happen. That's a tragedy to me for the so-called judicial process in our country. Hopefully, somewhere at some point in time, that will change. I hope so. I hope if we fight hard enough and make our voices known that at some point that that we can get that change, because it's really not real. And people are so disillusioned by this system. If you've never been in it, if you've never experienced it, you won't understand how phony and how it just has this beautiful covering over it. And it says all these nice things, but in actuality, they don't even exist. Thank you for the time.
Thank you for your comment. Professor, would you like to speak to that?
I'd like to comment. I think there's a lot of truth in what she has said. And before the show began, I looked up an article that I knew of that has that made a big impact in the legal community. It came out in 1967, and it's an article by Abraham Blumberg, a professor of criminology, and the title is The Practice of Law as Confidence Game, Organizational Co-optation of a Profession. And essentially, he is explaining in this article that the defense lawyer is part of a group of persons in the court, which include, of course, the judge, the prosecutor, and other personnel. And the client, this professor argued in this article, is a secondary figure, quote-unquote, in the court system, as in certain other bureaucratic settings. He becomes a means to other ends of the organization's incumbents. He may present doubts, contingencies, and pressures which challenge existing informal arrangements or disrupt them, but these tend to be resolved in favor of the continuance of the organization and its relations as before. In another paragraph, he says, as a consequence, an almost irreconcilable conflict is posed in terms of intense pressures to process large numbers of cases on the one hand, and the stringent ideological and legal requirements of, quote, due process of law on the other hand. A rather tenuous resolution of the dilemma has emerged in the shape of a large variety of bureaucratically ordained shortcuts, deviations, and outright rule violations adopted as court practices in order to meet production norms. So, as this caller pointed out, I guess what she's saying is there's no justice, that everyone's kind of in collusion to process cases. And, you know, one of the questions I was told might be raised here is why people go pro se. And I think in the criminal context, it has to do with the dissatisfaction with appointed counsel and the belief that appointed counsel just wants me to plead guilty, is not interested in investigating my defense or any fact. They just want to move the docket, get me to plead guilty, and move on to the next case. And so I think a lot of defendants, especially if they're veterans of the CJ system, they have a bad attitude toward appointed attorneys, whether they're actual public defenders or federal defenders or their retained counsel that are appointed. It's just they've got a record themselves, you know, a history, a tradition of trying to move cases and persuade clients to plead guilty. And this was, as I say, noticed and written about as early as 1967. And I think, unfortunately, the situation hasn't changed much.
And, you know, that's a great point that you make, Professor, because you we talked about it a little bit on the show early on, but you look at a CJA attorney and a federal court-appointed attorney, and they are basically there. They get paid for about 70 hours of work to even go through discovery in a typical case, to do interviews of potential, witnesses, to look over evidence. That's not 70 hours is not enough time. You can do 70 hours on the phone, sending letters, things of that nature before you really even get into the meat of the matter. And so that is, like you say, this has been dealt with since the 60s. And what kind of gets me a lot of time is that if this has been known in the public, why has the public not spoken to it? Why has the public not taken whatever vehicle there is to change the federal system and use that the same way with the immunity for prosecutors and the immunity for judges? You know, on one hand, some of it is good that you say, okay, we don't want them to be afraid to do their job. But if they do their job properly, if they uphold the law, and, you know, most of these prosecutors, they say, give me a plea deal because I'm not about justice. I'm about getting a conviction and maintaining my 98 to 99% conviction rate, most of which are done on plea deals. So if they do their job properly, they wouldn't have to be afraid of, you know, being sued or being someone coming after them for their misconduct if their conduct was proper. And so what I would like to ask you is, what is your take? And we need to go to break really quick, but just to give you a chance to think about it, what is your take on prosecutorial judicial misconduct and the fact that they get blanket immunity for this misconduct? And I guess that the other part of that question, how is it, and this is just my opinion, that the public has not had an outcry to say, why can we not get some type of vote to overturn this immunity to at least transform it into a way that protects the public interest instead of protecting, corrupt prosecutors, corrupt judges that do this misconduct and basically get away with it. So if you can think about that, and we'll catch you on the other side with your answer.
This is the Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Joining us this evening, Professor Jonah Goldschmidt, an expert, if you will, on pro se litigation. We'll be right back after this break. Don't go anywhere.
You are listening to Radio.
How can I let you know?
opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. The song that you heard during the break was B.B. Winans' Ultimate Sacrifice, and that's in honor of our military on this Veterans Day, 2014. So to all the veterans out there, we want to say thank you for your service. Joining us this evening and is Professor Jonah Goldschmidt. And Cliff, before the break, you had a question for Professor Smith. And so, Professor Smith, we'd like you to comment on what Cliff had posed to you before the break.
Right. Goldschmidt, actually. But let me comment. He asked about prosecutorial immunity. Why do we have it? There are corrupt prosecutors and so forth. Well, of course, the Supreme Court has held that they will create it, and they did create immunity from civil suits for prosecutors, like judges, a little bit different than judges, but it does essentially immunize, their rule immunizes prosecutors from money damages. The test that they announced in their decisions is called a functional test. In other words, the immunity is established because if prosecutors and judges don't have immunity, nobody would become a prosecutor or a judge. If they could be sued for anything that went wrong in the prosecutions that they pursue, but the test is as to the prosecutors, it's called a functional test, which means if whatever you're complaining about is within the normal function of a prosecutor, such as presenting evidence, if the prosecutor presents false evidence, he or she is still immunized, which is unfortunate, but because they're performing the, quote, normal function of a prosecutor, then they are immunized. But there are cases where prosecutors have been found liable. The Fred Hampton shooting in Chicago, the Black Panther raid on the Black Panther headquarters in the 70s, that was a raid by the Chicago PD that resulted in it was Mark Clark, I guess. He was basically assassinated by Chicago PD during the height of the Black Power movement and so forth. And the prosecutor at the time, Edward Hanrahan, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals held could be held liable because leading an illegal police raid is not within the normal function of a prosecutor. So it's a test that isn't ordinarily, it is ordinarily met in the context of any criminal prosecution. Whatever they do in court, presenting evidence, making argument, subpoenaing witnesses, all these things are normal prosecutorial functions, and no matter how they are engaged in, if they're engaged in bad faith, the immunity still applies. Do I agree with it? No. I was myself threatened by a prosecutor for advertising for divorce legal services back in 79-80 when attorneys were permitted to advertise for divorce in 1973. The prosecutor used a statute from the 1800s that had no application to me because it prohibited procuring divorces, which I wasn't procuring any divorce. I wasn't committing a fraud on the court. I had legitimate divorces. And yet he threatened me with arrest, with a prosecution for this misdemeanor. And the court, after I sued him, the court dismissed the case on prosecutorial immunity grounds, even though he admitted in the newspaper that several local attorneys had complained. So he was engaged in trying to shut me down to protect the local bar because I was undercutting their legal fees. So I'm very sensitive to this prosecutorial immunity question. Now, with respect to judges, they have absolute immunity except if they act beyond their jurisdiction. So if a, housing court judge orders the arrest of a juvenile, that could be a case where there is liability because the judge, a housing court judge, has no jurisdiction over juvenile cases. So as long as they act within their jurisdiction, no money damage action will lie against a judge. Currently, Congress does permit by statute a declaratory judgment action against judges for their unconstitutional conduct, but we're only able to get a declaration that a judge violated somebody's rights, but there's no money damage element to it.
And we're going to take a caller and then get back into this, Professor. But I think where I take issue is that not from the monetary standpoint even, but just from the fact that why can't a prosecutor himself be prosecuted and something substantial happen when it's found that he's committed prosecutorial misconduct? Why can't a judge, when they do something egregious or illegal or, just unethical or immoral while they're on the bench, why can't that be, grounds basically to remove them? Those are the part of the...
Judges do get removed. There are judicial conduct organizations in every state that do address serious misconduct, and as well as in the legal profession, attorneys are disbarred or suspended every day. It is difficult. I mean, the standard is quite high, as the caller mentioned earlier, but there are cases of judicial misconduct that are pursued.
Okay, let's take our caller. Gwendolyn, you are on the air. You have a question or a comment for the guest?
I had a comment. I was looking at the program. It was saying, why do people go pro se? And I just wanted to make my comments with my views that I believe that a lot of the people go pro se because they know the ins and outs of their cases. They feel like the court-appointed attorneys are not doing their job and that they are basically, quote-unquote, sleeping with the prosecutor to try to just, get a case closed and to get a plea bargain, which you have to realize that lawyers, and this is why I strongly became a lawyer, is you're supposed to be a litigator and an advocate for your client. And if you have the best interest of your client, if you have to go to court and litigate, go to court and litigate. There's no reason, why you should be afraid of the prosecutor if you know you have a stacked up case to be able to win that case. Then I heard you also discuss, the outcry of the public. And one thing that I noticed, I teach classes to the public, and when you do that, you realize how knowledgeable people are. They don't know what goes on in the courtroom. Even when I go to court, basically the only people that are there are those that are involved in the system, those that are being prosecuted, those that are the lawyers and the judges. And so a lot of the public, unless it affects them personally, they don't even go in, which they have the right to go in and sit down and listen to the cases, but a lot of people, man is about himself. These people are involved with their own lives, their own situations, until something happens and affects their lives. Once that happens, then they have you know, this, I want to get involved. But a lot of it is because they're not knowledgeable, because they don't, it's not affecting them. And it would be a great outcry if people could go in and see what happens in the courtroom. A lot of the people don't even know the judges. They don't know their, you know, the stand they take. And as far as the attorneys themselves, the attorneys need to stop being afraid of litigating, and they need to stop being afraid of trying to upset a judge. If you know what you're doing is right, then you take a stand for what's right. You don't worry. That judge, to me, is just another lawyer as myself. Half of them don't even know the law. They don't read the law like they should, but they get the position either, I don't know, by knowing someone or a political move. But the attorneys themselves need to really become an advocate for their clients. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment.
Well, she certainly is basically mirroring whatever I said and your last caller said. You know, it is this idea that production, moving the cases, closing the cases, going on to the next case. This is one of the major institutional goals of the system. Unfortunately, there aren't enough public defenders. They're overworked. They're underpaid. You know, she's right. To some extent, they're in cahoots, so to speak, which is what Professor Blumberg was writing about in 67. They're not necessarily doing it in bad faith, but it's just a function of the structure of the system, and it needs to be reformed. I agree with everything that the last caller said.
And Professor Lamont Banks here again, going into what you had stated earlier, in regards, I think when you said when a judge or a prosecutor steps out of the role, and I have heard and familiarized myself with that terminology in regards to some cases where they leave the role of prosecutor or they leave the role of judge. Now, judge, of course, it seems to be the standard is a lot higher, but in the IRP6 case, the leaving of the role of prosecutor is so evident in the IRP6 case. I mean, we're talking about issues in regards to subpoenas being interfered with on FBI, I believe it was the FBI agents. Is that right, Cliff?
Yes.
Subpoenas, interference happening there, obstruction of justice. These are things that are grave, in my opinion, grave miscarriages and actions against the judicial process. And when you go to the point when you say the system is set up where it is to let's get on to the next case, well, that alone and that mindset goes against due process automatically.
That's right. And Lamont, when you have things like a prosecutor talking to your defense witness and the judge, when you're a pro se litigant, the judge does not step in to say, prosecutor, why are you in touch with the defense's witnesses? That is when you can say with all confidence that the system has failed. There's nothing else to say except it has failed. It has not done what it should for the defendant.
And I mean, and my point to the professor is that I agree with his professor, excuse me, your position on these things, and they are somewhat. I understand in some cases where you have the common ground, if you will, the common sense situations where we have a generality, if you will, where a prosecutor may step out of the role. I'm saying, should there be, and I guess I'll pose this question to you, and I presume you would agree, that something has to be done to find a balance where, yes, we want prosecutors to do their job, we want judges not to be afraid to do their job, but where is the line where we have exceeded that and gone beyond that line and to the point where something or some type of oversight or some type of committee of some sort can be set up to oversee actions that happened across that line?
Well, you know, defendants and really any party in any court can file a judicial misconduct allegation or complaint. Typically, if it is in reference to an act that was taken in connection with ongoing litigation, civil or criminal, those complaints are going to be dismissed because the appellate court is the remedy for those kinds of things. If something is done that is outside the record, where there's no transcript, there's no paperwork in the file regarding the conduct, that is one area in which a judicial conduct organization can address. And in the federal courts, the system is such that the chief judge of the federal circuit is usually the one to whom these complaints about federal judges would go. And then every circuit has a committee that reviews these complaints. But again, like in the state judicial conduct organizations, complaints are going to be dismissed readily if they relate to something pertaining to the litigation, civil or criminal, because again, that is a matter for the Court of Appeals. And it sounds like, having read the blurb I received before this show began, can be raised and hopefully have been raised. I don't know if they're trying to go pro se on appeal. I wouldn't recommend it, but they certainly seem to have raised numerous issues of fairness, due process, and so forth. I don't know if anyone knows what their situation is appeal wise, but I'd be interested to know what happened or what will happen on appeal.
Well, Professor, the appellate court did come back, and we took the same position that, hey, if you have a portion of the trial transcript, especially an entire sidebar where a situation where the defendants are saying the judge violated our Fifth Amendment rights and said that either one of us take the stand or she will rest our case, when you have that situation and there's no record of it, on the in the court transcript, the judge says that she said something that is not on the record. The defendant says that the judge said something that's not on the record. The court reporter gives no reason for why she did not record that. And this is court reporter Darlene Martinez, Judge Christine Arguello, and the IRP6 as the defendants. Then our take was that absolutely the Court of Appeals should have something to say about that as far as due process being violated. They came back, did not deal with the Fifth Amendment or the missing portion of the transcript issue, and kind of walked around it and said that the defendant, Mr. Barnes, who did take the stand, that he had done that voluntarily, which when we read that opinion, it caught us all by surprise and sent us a few steps back, because the whole time after Mr. Barnes took the stand against his will, he has contended that it was against his will and that the judge did compel him to get on the stand with the threat of resting his case and presenting it to the jury before the defense would like to have had that. So that is what happened during the appeal, and we are pretty much at a loss as to why that was the case. They did not go pro se. They did have an attorney. Attorney Gwendolyn Solomon did represent them on their appeal, did a great job at it, presented these things to the appellate court, and like you said, the appellate court refused to deal with those issues.
Well, maybe now is the time to file a misconduct complaint with the, is it the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals there in Colorado?
Yes. It is the 10th Circuit.
Oh, I would, suggest that maybe that's a route to take if you can get affidavits together and make that claim. It's really unfortunate there was nothing on the record. That's really unfortunate.
And Professor, those are actions that we have began to take, those types of steps. Not only within the 10th Circuit, but also with other avenues that are available to the IRP6 as well as a just cause. So we certainly appreciate everything that you're saying about this, and validating some of the things that that we have kind of suspected all along. And so, you know, to have someone with your background in this area of expertise is certainly appreciated. So Professor Jonah Goldschmidt joining us this evening, and again, thank you for joining us. How can folks get in contact with you if they'd like to have you, you know, speak with their group or represent them, or at least, you know, get some additional information from you regarding pro se litigation?
And sorry to interrupt you, Professor. Before you do that, just for your information, a complaint, a misconduct complaint, has been filed with the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, and we are waiting to hear back on that. As of yet, there has not been a response. We definitely will keep you abreast of what happens in that arena.
Well, people can get a hold of me. I'm at Loyola University Chicago. I can give you my email address. Email address is jgold, S as in Sam, C, at luc.edu. Again, it's jgoldsc@luc.edu.
Awesome. And folks can go to our archives at ajcradio.com. Again, ajcradio.com. And listen to the archives of the interview with Professor Jonah Goldschmidt, Associate Professor of the Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology. Thank you again for joining us. We're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we're going to close things out. We're going to go and do a listen to our profile of the wrongfully convicted, and then we'll be right back. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Thank you again, Professor. Good night. At the inception of A Just Cause Coast to Coast, the host and crew decided to devote a segment of each show to an exoneree moment. The purpose of the exoneree moment was to outline the case and highlight the circumstances that led to a wrongful conviction. AJC Radio also wanted to highlight the successes and failures of the justice system, understanding why the system failed and what ultimately turned the tide and cleared their name. We wanted to hear the personal first-hand accounts. They were appalling, emotional, astounding, and overwhelming. Lives devastated by the system. After many interviews, we discovered that many of the stories we outlined didn't quite fit the term exoneree or exonerated. Most of the people who shared their stories were released from the building, but not from the system. They struggled to get their records expunged and clear their names, find suitable employment and housing, obtain restitution from the state, and reconnect with their families and friends. And it hardly fit the definition of exonerated, which means to free from guilt of blame, to clear from a charge of guilt or fault, to exculpate. Release conveys to free from confinement, bondage, obligation, or pain, to free from anything that restrains. The spirit of the exoneree moment lives on, to tell the personal stories of those whose lives have been devastated by the justice system, but we've renamed the segment to a profile of the wrongly convicted. These are the stories of lives taken and returned, but must be rebuilt, adapted, reestablished, and transformed. The profile of a wrongly convicted.
In 1983, 19-year-old Andre Davis from Chicago was sentenced to 80 years in prison for the murder and rape of a 3-year-old girl, a crime he swore he did not commit. The child was found next door at the Tuckers' home where Davis just visited that day. Davis was arrested after a friend of the Tuckers, Donald DeRoe, told police Davis told him he killed a white woman at the residence. After two trials where DeRoe and the Tuckers testified against him, he was convicted. At age 50, DNA concluded Davis was innocent and was released July 6, 2012. The DNA samples at the crime scene matched Maurice Tucker's genetic profile, but prosecutors claimed DNA evidence was not enough to charge him. While I'm happy to be free with my innocence established by the courts, I feel that those who were responsible for robbing me of the best years of my life shall be held legally responsible for doing me so terribly wrong. He filed a wrongful conviction suit at the U.S. District Court. This has been a profile of the wrongfully convicted with AJC Radio.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you educational awareness and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and our special contributing analyst, Lamont Banks. And again, we want to thank Professor Jonah Goldschmidt for joining us this evening. Lamont, you said you had a couple of other items to add with regards to pro se litigation.
Yeah, this was a article I pulled up. This is some years ago, and on 2007. Says a criminal defendant for self-representation did not knowingly waive his right to a lawyer where the court informed him of the charge against him and misstated the potential sentence that he faced. Now, maybe you guys can help me out with this one as far as the IRP 6 case in regards to what they were actually told, possible sentences. But this judge went as far as to do something a little bit beyond his scope. It says here his remarks included the admonishment: I want to unequivocally tell you and strongly recommend to you, don't do this. In most cases, it's a disaster. This is at a hearing where a defendant is asking the judge to go pro se because he has his court-appointed attorney or public defender, if you will, was not doing their job. He then returns, basically scares and intimidates the defendant and says, I want to let you know that this is, in most cases, a disaster. Now, number one, how do you tell a defendant that who is basically taking advantage of his right to self-representation? So if a judge goes in there, and anybody that goes into a courtroom in most cases that's never been in that situation – is usually there's a little bit of intimidation by the judge because of the power that the judge's position holds and what he can and cannot do. In this particular case, I guess the appellate court overturned. This man ultimately was convicted and was sentenced to, I believe, 20 to 30 years behind bars. And the appellate court overturned the conviction based upon that the defendant was talked to or stated by this judge on this particular level and what he was told. So that gives you a little bit of an indication that the status quo, if you will, in courtrooms across this country is to discourage you from actually taking advantage of your right for self-representation. And maybe perhaps, and this is my opinion, this is where defendants fail in their pro se presentation because they are intimidated
exactly
by the acts of the judge.
They've been intimidated not only by the prosecutor, by the charges against them, but then the judge. If you have this judge saying this instead of telling this person, you know, just their rights, so you have the right to represent yourself.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with it. You can state any point of the law that any attorney could. But it also speaks to what the judges, what the instructions that they give to a juror. If you have this judge that says, you know, basically you're going down the wrong path, you're going to be convicted. Now, the question is, why can't this same judge, when the jury comes in, say, hey, jury, this man is innocent until he's proven guilty. There is no crime at this point that has been proven against him. He is presumed innocent, and until the prosecutor gives you something beyond a reasonable doubt, you have to maintain that this man is innocent.
Well, they seem to throw that in casually. It's kind of
right.
Like if you read an article and at the bottom there's a side note.
Yes.
So-and-so. That's what they seem, in my opinion, to use when they say the defendant is innocent. He is not guilty of a crime. But they want to put in bold print.
Right. Don't represent
yourself. These are the charges that this man is charged. So what? Guess what? In the mind of the jury, they see bold.
Yes.
They don't see the side note that this man is presumed innocent.
They don't see the little footnote.
That is all at the discretion of the judge, unfortunately. And that's why the system has to be changed.
That's exactly why the system has to be changed. And until we, as the people of the United States, stand up and make our voices heard together, that we won't stand for the judicial process being handled this way. That because at any point, you can become a defendant in a criminal case. I mean, when you look at the IRP 6 case, and because they went in debt, they got an indictment against them. If you have a credit card, if you have a mortgage, if you have an auto loan, and for some reason you lose your job, you're not able to pay that, guess what? The case of IRP 6 can be used as precedent to say that the federal government is coming after you. So people, that's why you need to stand up, understand the laws, understand your rights, and fight the things that are wrong, fight the part of the process that needs to be changed. From my standpoint, that's the whole thing. Like I said before, hey, you know, we used to say don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. But if that baby is dead and rotten, you got to go ahead and put him in the trash.
For archives of the Just Cause Coast to Coast, go to AJCRadio.com for more lively conversation about the injustice in the land. And like Cliff and Plant was saying, you know, you need to get involved. You need to find ways to get involved to help to change the system. For more information about a Just Cause, go to www.a-justcause. Again, www.a-justcause.com. You could also use your contributions. Click on the donate button on that website. For 24/7 programming, go to live365.com. We ask you to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and then Sunday morning, 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time, you can catch us on Progressive Radio Network. You can get there by going to rn.fm. Again, for more information about the IRP 6, go to freetheirp6.org. Freetheirp6.org. Keep the IRP 6 in your prayers. That's Dave Banks. Dave Zappolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clint Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Gary Walker. And Cliff, we also like to put out that request to former jurors from the IRP 6 case.
That's right. Jurors, you're listening out there, and you hear information that you didn't on this show that you did not receive during the trial proceedings, reach out to us. We'll give you all the information that we have. You can call us at 1-855-529-4255, again, that's 855-529-4255, or send us an email at contact@a-justcause.com.
We want to thank Olivia and Ms. Barbara for all your hard work. We appreciate you guys, everything you do to make the show flow smoothly.
Yes.
I can't say it smoothly, but the show flows smoothly.
We want to say thank you to our production team, K&D, Dr. Kevin, Kyle, Dustin, Jack, helping out Hill. If it weren't for them, you would not hear what it is that we have to say to our production. You give us accurate and up-to-date information so that we can deliver that to you to the truth. We know you out there. We appreciate it.
Join us each Tuesday and Thursday right here on A Just Cause Coast to Coast from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time for more of A Just Cause Coast to Coast on this Thursday. Yeah, you definitely don't want to miss this one. We're going to do a little bit of background research. Our research team is working on it. We're going to pull information on other nations and other countries and compare the U.S. justice system to those of other countries. You know, everyone always says that we have the best justice system in the world, and we know that that is not true.
That's a bunch of crap.
And so we are going to actually compare the United States system to other systems. Cliff.
I want to say thank you to Professor Jonah Goldschmidt. Appreciate you taking time tonight out of your evening to spend.
This is A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman for Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. That's all we have for this evening's edition. Good night, America.
Good night.
Good night.